ghost, ghost, I know you live within me. Feel your eyes, you fly in thunder clouds above the city.
Hi, I'm Tim Gruson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Gruson Leach Podcast, episode 62. Here at the New Republic, Grayson, this is episode 2 of your nodule-less existence. Do I have more time of you this time? Do you feel strong? Are the pipes piping? Are you feeling like ready to like talk through a wall?
I'm going to say yes to all of those questions. My pipes are definitely piping.
That's good. That's a question I feel like I could ask you even long before you actually had the surgery.
Yes.
It's always good. That's the most disturbing, by the way, verse in the 12 Days of Christmas. Grierson's pipes are piping. This is the Grierson Leach Podcast. We remind you, as always, to review us on iTunes. By the way, I encourage everyone, definitely review us on iTunes. We've had a lot of people tell us that, hey, did you get my review? Or please review this movie. You must be on iTunes. You have to subscribe on iTunes, write your review on iTunes. That's how we do it, because it makes people easier to find the podcast. The more reviews you get on iTunes, the more people find the show. So I hate to be a stickler about this. However, if you do want to give us a review to do us, make us do a reboot, please do it on iTunes. It makes it much easier. Also, find us on SoundCloud, newrepublic.com. Email us at GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com. I know there's been some issues on my end with the audio where it shifts back and forth, left and right. I think I've got that fixed this week. He says, while you listen to him going, nope, I'm working on it, is basically the point. But this week we have two reboot movies. The first to us comes to us from Robbie the Pirate. Yar. Robbie the Pirate says, great podcast for film criticism, 5 stars. Grierson and Leach have made a podcast that dives headfirst into the world of film criticism with rad results. I think our results are always quite rad, Grierson.
Do pirates use rad? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, he is the skater now. That's a different kind of pirate, I suppose. They give great in-depth analysis of current releases and reboots and share their breadth of film knowledge in a way that is both enjoyable and enlightening. Skip the fluff. Listen to Grierson and Leach. Let's put that on our lawn sign.
I was going to say, thank you, Mr. the Pirate. That's actually very, very, that's very nice.
Skip the fluff. Listen to Grierson and Leach. My reboot recommendation is Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show. So our first reboot movie will be The Last Picture Show. Oh, and Grierson, then we have our second reboot movie. Oh, do we?
Oh, yes.
It comes to us from Inglebone. Inglebone says, great insight, 5 stars. Found these guys on Deadspin a while ago and have enjoyed the reviews, now still at the New Republic. They have great rapport and it comes out in the show. Helped inform me of a lot of great movies that I could have missed out on by not listening or reading. Now that's a nice little review. That's like you read that review, you don't expect anything but dangerous is coming. That's just some nice words from Inglebone. Thanks, Inglebone. And then he says the movie The Room by the great Tommy Wiseau. So Grierson and I, as discussed last week, will be discussing, The Room. But first, we have a new movie to discuss. Our one big release of the week is Ghost in the Shell.
I have been watching you. You have to remember.
I saw someone down there. He wasn't human.
Ghost in the Shell is the American remake, live action remake of the 1995 Japanese anime, which is, of course, based on a manga from, I believe, the late 80s. It's directed by Rupert Sanders, who did Snow White and the Huntsman, which nobody remembers fondly. This movie stars Scarlett Johansson as the Major, who is a cyborg who doesn't exactly remember her life as a human being. She remembers that she nearly drowned in an accident with her parents, but her mind was kept alive and put into this new synthetic body, where she is now a super-killing machine who helps work in law enforcement in some futuristic city that looks kind of like Tokyo, though they don't actually say the city's name at any point during the movie. And if you've seen the 1995 movie, or if you've read the manga, it's kind of like those, but it's it sort of takes those as a riff. It's a platform for which to jump off on this new movie. She and her cohorts are going after this sort of shadowy terrorist figure played by Michael Pitt. And what we are going to discover, I'm not going to say a lot of spoilers, maybe we'll get into this when we talk about the movie, is that he has some information about her past and that they are more connected than maybe she realizes. I went back and rewatched the original Ghost in the Shell from 1995 to prepare for this movie. And I had seen it when it came out. I actually remembered seeing it in the theaters at the time. And I remember liking it and thinking it was pretty cool at the time. Went back and rewatched it the day before I saw the new movie. And I have to admit that I thought it was okay. And it seemed like a thing that in some ways was a bit dated. I think some of its messages about man and machine coming together and the sort of like future shock paranoia that goes on in the movie feels very much of a pre-millennium tension time. It was still good, but it wasn't quite as great as I remembered. I say all of that because I'm actually somebody who liked the new Ghost in the Shell. I think, first of all, in terms of just visual rapture, this movie is absolutely gorgeous. It's pretty hard in this day and age to make a dystopian society movie look remotely original, because you've got, you know, Blade Runner and Minority Report and everything kind of in between, The Matrix and other films. They've kind of created the template for what those types of cityscapes look like. I think Rupert Sanders and his team actually do a pretty great job of making this movie from beginning to end kind of jaw-dropping in terms of just how inventive and imaginative and just sort of flat-out stunning a lot of these sequences are. And I think a lot of credit also has to go to Scarlett Johansson. We'll get into the whitewashing here in a bit, but I think that this movie is sort of a nice amalgam of performances she's done before, whether it's Black Widow in the Marvel movies, or it's, you know, her Lucy character in Lucy, or even a little bit of Under the Skin. I think it also kind of plays into what makes this character effective. I don't think this movie is incredibly original. Obviously, it's based on several pieces of source material. But I actually found it pretty emotional and engaging in a way I wasn't necessarily expecting.
Yeah, I'm not really with you on this one. I do think that some of the visual stuff is interesting. If it's original in a derivative way, if that makes sense, is that it takes like the idea of the Blade Runner and of the Minority Report and adds a little bit, basically, with the idea of these like massive skyscraper-sized hologram advertisements that seem to be running throughout the city. Like, there's nothing new about this particular dystopia. There's a big massive corporation that is secretly trying to destroy all of us and trying to keep its secrets, and they're taking innocent people and turning them into all sorts of terrible things. Like, this is another of those big technological, evil, futuristic, dystopian corporations that we have seen literally. And I think they were in a Police Academy sequel at this point. Like, they're in every single movie. So to me, I found that pretty dull, to be honest. And I've actually found, while there's a little bit of a mystery as to why, as to what exactly has happened to Scarlett Johansson and what's happened to her character, and she's trying to figure that out, it's not something that I found particularly surprising when we find out what it is. It actually seems fairly like par for the course in a movie like this. So for me, if I'm not able, while I do think a lot of the way that the movie looks is interesting to look at and it keeps me going, it feels disconnected from the action that's going on, which I found pretty emotionally uninvolving. Part of that is Johansson, who I agree is good, and I wrote about this in my New Republic review, also bringing up Under the Skin and bringing up Lucy, because it does feel there is just that alien quality where she always seems to just kind of be sitting back and observing the things that are happening around her in this dispassionate way, which is done to a rather horrifying effect in Under the Skin, and I think to an amusing effect in Lucy. Here, I feel like it's just distancing. I feel like she's almost like a wax figure. You kind of stand outside, and so there's not that emotion. Even in Under the Skin, where she's this completely alien character, there are times where her emotion is very powerful and very affecting. Here, she is I find her just a little bit too distancing for a movie that needs a little bit more connection. I joked in the review that she's kind of spins the whole movie with that look that Keanu Reeves has in The Matrix right after he's had everything downloaded, but doesn't realize he knows how to do all this stuff yet. And so when and I think that's kind of right. And I don't think that's bad. I think it's a choice. I don't think it's because she's a bad actress or anything. I just don't think it's enough for this movie, which frankly I think needs a little bit more of a connection there than we necessarily get.
Yeah, it's interesting because I did engage with that character. And one of the things I think that this movie does correctly is I don't think it invests very much in the idea of, oh man, in the future, like, how will we tell, like, the replicants from the humans? They're going to be so... I think they actually, the movie is smart enough to go, you know what, that trope is done enough. We shouldn't do that. And I actually did find that there were some other things in the movie, like, thematically, that I found kind of interesting. Some of the stuff in terms of, like, drone warfare, I think is actually kind of interesting. And also, just while it's not, I totally agree, it's not a big surprise. I mean, they kind of give it away in the commercials, I feel like, in terms of, like, what her deal is. And then, by the way, that's a sign of a studio that has no faith in its movie, that they have to, like, oh, but don't worry, there's this twist in it, and we're just going to tell you it so you'll be interested. That's a sign of a studio that has no faith in their own movie. And I agree that that's not a super surprise and kind of par for the course, but what I think actually works in it is, mild spoiler coming, the idea about these different ghosts in the movie, that in some ways it's kind of like, to me it felt like a metaphor in some ways for whether it's child abuse or foster homes or foster children in certain ways. This idea of people who have been taken and sort of mentally abused and gone through this type of thing, essentially to become like child soldiers in a certain way. It's not a perfect metaphor. It doesn't entirely work, but I actually found that kind of interesting. And that to me was emotionally engaging enough that it works for me. I actually think Johansson's a little more emotional than I think you're giving her credit for. Cause I think she's got like these amazing eyes, you know, which I think actually work to sort of suggest a thinking and a feeling that's going on with that character. Cause I think also to the movie's credit, this is not a movie. This is not the RoboCop model of, I do not feel anything. Now I feel something at the end. It actually doesn't do that arc. So while I agree with you that overall the movie is sort of a nice simulation of the earlier movies that have come before it, I think that there's enough that they also say, let's not do this. Let's not do this, because these things have been done a decent amount. Also, one last thing I just have to say, I'm a big fan of Juliette Binoche as an actress. I am starting to worry that she should not do many English language movies, because both with this and Godzilla, I kind of feel like she seems lost. And there were parts of me that thought during the movie where I thought, when is someone going to do like the video mashup of her character from Clouds of Sils Maria in the theater? And then they show her in the movie of Ghost in the Shell watching herself on screen. Like, this in some ways does feel like the movie that they're kind of making fun of. In Clouds of Sils Maria. I realize making that comment does not help my case for why I think this movie actually works, but I could not help feeling that way while watching it.
It was definitely funny. There wasn't a single time she wasn't on screen where I wasn't thinking of Clouds of Sils Maria, when she has to recite that terrible dialogue. Oh, it was very amusing. So I totally agree. So we probably need to talk about the whitewashing aspect. I find it interesting about it, because I think that a lot of times those discussions tend to be binary, in that you either believe this or you believe that, and you think it's a big deal, or you not think it's a big deal, or you think it's a big deal, but you want to just concentrate on the movie, and so you can say, yep, that's bad that they did this, but let's just talk about the film. What I find interesting about Ghost in the Shell, and I'll be careful not to spoil here too much, is there seems to be a plot point about the idea of whitewashing this Japanese movie with a white actor, and really two white actors in the lead roles, kind of baked into the plot of the movie. It seems to be almost an explanation of one of the things that happens to her. And I found it one of the more interesting parts of the film, and one of the things that felt more thought through, which actually got me a little annoyed with the film, which is the idea. I don't think the film has as much to say or as much thought process put into it as you do, but I do think this part does, the addressing of the idea of the whitewashing and why, how they might do it and how it plays into the plot of the film. It's something that I think the movie's actually thought about, which I found kind of irritating. Like this, like it felt like the only time the movie like revs itself up to have like a thought or like an extra level to the plot is in this defensive kind of, here's why we did this. Don't worry. If you try to criticize us for this, we can show you this and be like, no, here's, look, it's part of the plot of the movie. That's why there's these two white Americans as these lead roles. Like, and to me, that, while I got what they were doing, I found myself a little irritated about it. It felt like, well, yes, the reason you're having to give this explanation, like you can tell me this is the explanation that fits in the plot of the movie, but we all know the real reason that Scarlett Johansson is the white American lead in this role, because, you know, it's easier for the box office and it's easier to sell internationally and so on, and which is exactly, of course, the type of self-perpetuating the problem that makes this an issue as we go along. And so for me, the idea that they wrote this extra part into the plot to try to justify that away and give a talking point, theoretically, when you're discussing the film, while I think it's an somewhat interesting way to do it, it still felt like, oh, so this is the thing you're investing in, whereas I wish I would have invested in so much other stuff.
Yeah, I'm probably like half a notch higher in terms of that than you are, because I think it speaks to the fact that the movie in general worked better for me. Yeah, and you want to talk about like binaries and not binaries. I think that plot point works really nicely, but I also get exactly why they're justifying it in that way. It's impossible for me to watch it and not think, oh, that's actually a really clever way of addressing it and kind of in some ways leaning into why whitewashing remains a problem. And at the same time, but it's not necessarily challenging that. It's not really changing that. It's sort of saying,
I feel like, honestly, yeah. I feel like we're talking around it a little bit. So I feel like I just want to actually explain it. So if there's a little bit of a spoiler here. But I actually feel like this is an important enough topic. I want to explain what we're talking about so people aren't listening and being like, what? I'm very confused. They're talking, like, we're really talking about it. So there's a little bit of spoiler here. But the idea, here's your spoiler. So again, if you don't want to hear this spoiler, wait until the music for the Last Picture Show comes on. Fast forward to that point. But basically, the idea is, it turns out that Major was originally a Japanese, was a runaway, a Japanese girl who was a runaway and had gone to like kind of this commune of fellow Japanese runaways, including Michael Pitt's character. And there, they're taken away, and their brains are taken and put into the bodies of these robots. And the corporation has made them into the same way that, frankly, the corporation, the Paramount that made this movie, has made them into front-facing white Americans. And so that's why they are that way, even though the brains are actually of Japanese people, which, again, that is, again, I agree with you, it's kind of a clever way to do it, except also kind of fuck off, if that makes sense. Is that like, yeah, I get it. That's if you have to justify this is a not, you're at least acknowledging it and trying to justify it in a way. But another way to do it would be to actually cast Japanese people in the role. And I think that's why it feels, while clever, still kind of irritating.
Yeah. And again, I don't think it's quite the level of F off, but I do feel like, again, it's like, see? To me, yeah. It's a more problematic equivalent of sitcoms, like, noticing or noting the fact that they have product placement in their shows to make it seem like, see, we're self-aware. It seems like a more problematic version of that type of thing. I don't think the movie is combative about that. And I think this is where you can see the dividing line in terms of where we feel about this movie. I actually found that to be somewhat emotional, because to me, when Scarlett Johansson's character, when the Major discovers this, there is a sense of the true loss of the identity that she had. The idea that I don't actually look like my mother. I actually found it to be pretty effective in terms of an idea of, oh, I really don't know who I am. And I really have been profoundly changed by this, you know, evil corporation, so that I don't even look like where I came from. Again, I completely agree in general with what you're saying about that. But that actually, I thought, kind of worked. And I actually found that to be, again, part of what I found emotionally involving in the movie.
All right, so what'd you give it?
I gave it a B. I think it's perfectly solid.
Yeah, I give it a C. I'm not mortally wounded by this movie. I think there is some good stuff. And if this sounded like a criticism of Scarlett Johansson, I think she's good. She's very, I mentioned in the review, like she's one of the main reasons to watch. She's just a compelling figure across the board just to watch, even if it's a confusing. And frankly, I would recommend, though, I think you would certainly agree with this, even though you like this movie, go watch Under the Skin.
No.
Everyone just go watch Under the Skin.
Yeah, I would say that all the movies that we talked about, whether it's the Marvel movies or Lucy or Under the Skin, I think they're all better than Ghost in the Shell. But the other thing I would say is that I actually kind of like this Scarlett Johansson has held on to this part of her career where she's still a respected like actress, but at the same time has actually become like this ass-kicking like action hero. I actually now enjoy her like shooting guns and kicking ass because I think she actually does it pretty well. I always find it kind of fun, and I also think she's pretty fun in this movie. So.
All right. Well, that is Ghost in the Shell. Our first reboot film is The Last Picture Show.
President Truman will be here tomorrow, so all you folks in Dallas turn out, cheer. This is Cowboy Rhythms on KTRN, Wichita Falls. Here's Hank Williams' big hit tune, Cold, Cold Heart.
I try so hard, my dear, to show
you. You ain't ever gonna mount to nothing. Already spent a dime this morning, ain't even had a decent breakfast.
The Last Picture Show came out in 1971. It was directed by Mr. Peter Bogdanovich, based on Larry McMurtry's novel, The Last Picture Show. This was Bogdanovich's first film, and when it came out, it was, in terms of incredible debuts, it was compared to Orson Welles' Citizen Kane quite a lot. Is it as good as Citizen Kane? Maybe not, but it's pretty darn close, I have to say. It takes place in a very small town somewhere in northern Texas. It's the span of about a year from the fall of 1951 through the fall of 1952. And it's a small town in Texas where not much of anything is happening. And we see the characters who are still living in this small, sleepy, kind of going away little town, which includes Dwayne, played by Jeff Bridges, and his best friend Sonny, who's played by Timothy Bottoms. I haven't seen this movie in quite some time, and so I want to thank Mr. the Pirate for recommending this movie. I have talked on this podcast, we have talked on this podcast, about the fact that I am pretty anti-nostalgia in a lot of ways. I think that nostalgia can be an incredibly crippling sort of thing to kind of be sucked in by. And one of the things that I absolutely love about The Last Picture Show, among its many other great attributes, is that I think this is one of the great anti-nostalgia movies, because it was made in the early 1970s. It's about the early 1950s. But this movie has absolutely no illusions about how much better things used to be back then. It also gets around the problem of how do you make a movie about people in high school and not make it seem kind of cozy and nostalgic and warm in that way, too. This movie is so incredibly clear-eyed and dispassionate about the world that it depicts. And what's interesting about it is that it's the exact opposite of a Richard Linklater movie, say Everybody Wants Some, which is very warm and very nostalgic and very wise in certain ways. But his movies are always so affectionate about his characters. I would actually submit that Bogdanovich does not have much affection for these characters. It's not that he doesn't like them, but I think he sees them very clearly as people who are not going anywhere, don't have great prospects, and frankly, don't necessarily deserve anything better than that. Kind of across the board, from top to bottom, the performances in this movie are absolutely terrific. Both with this movie and I think with Linklater's movies, they're so incredibly intimate and present that you feel like you are there in the moment every single second. But what happens in the movie, nothing really kind of remarkable kind of occurs, but a sense of a small town and a small town that's kind of dying, in the sense that we either have to get the hell out of here or we're going to die in this town with the town, is incredibly palpable kind of from the first second. It has an incredible collection of Hank Williams songs, up and down the film. And I had forgotten this, an incredible collection of some of the most awkward and painful sex scenes. And they all feel so incredibly right in terms of, I haven't thought about how awful making out in a car in high school was in quite some time. And I'm generally happy about that. But this movie takes me back to that feeling. But again, that feeling of watching it is not a rosy, oh, wasn't it great back then? It's very clear about this time in people's lives, but also the adult characters and kind of what they're suffering through as essentially the people who are guarding this way station that's going away as they watch all of the kids go off to bigger and better things. I absolutely love this movie.
Yeah, I think it's pretty great too. And you know, the dispassionate part I think is the best way to look at it, because this is not like a lot of these people are dicks. Like a lot of these people are selfish. A lot of those people, they don't think about anyone other than themselves. And what's interesting, and I find it fascinating that the lead in this, Timothy Bottoms' character, is Sonny, is so passive. Like, I think it really works for the movie that he is this really kind of passive character who certainly, I think he's a well-rounded character. I think that there are moments where he, you're on his side and there are moments where you're not. But it's telling that I think a strong-willed character in that part, or someone that really drove the action, would totally miss the point. Like, this is not a story about, oh, is Sonny going to make it out of this town? Is Sonny, because I mean, he seems like one of the nicer people in the movie. He seems like there's a depth to him that say you don't see in, say, Dwayne, Jeff Bridges' character. But there's not a question of like, so is this guy going to, like in a lesser movie, the question of is this guy bigger than this town? Or is he going to get out of here? Is he, would be like his major plot point. But it's never really hinted at. There's no real drive to him. There's no real push in one direction or the other. The most active thing he does is have this affair with Cloris Leachman, an old woman who, Cloris Leachman, won an Oscar for this movie, as did Ben Johnson. And he has this affair with her, but it seems just so removed from it and so just in a way that kids are, to be honest, in the way that teenagers are, of like involved in this very serious situation and in this very, like with this very fragile woman who desperately needs him and seems just kind of not ambivalent, but unaware of it. And I think that is an ongoing theme in this movie, is people hurt each other. People do like reckless things. People are mean. People are kind. It's funny, you talked about Dogville in the past. I don't think this movie is as actively angry as Dogville, but I do think that it has a lot to say about the indifference of towns like this. And really the difference to everyone, but really the idea that these people is small and quaint and nice, it means that their inertia and their lack of real activity in large ways is almost hostile in its indifference to you. And I think that, and every character has that. And every character has that in their own way, in a way that I think fits well. It's funny, you know, Bogdanovich had been a film critic before he did this. He'd written a ton about Orson Welles and John Ford. And it does feel like a John Ford movie. It feels like these vast plains of nothingness surrounded where people can just do whatever they want. And here, they do nothing. They just kind of are just casually mean to each other sometimes because they're bored in a way that I think is upsetting. While still, the movie's very funny. The movie has some very funny moments. There's so many like great little scenes. I think the famous scene where Sybil Shepherd is about to go into the nude pool has like these five or six of very just like clever, smart, emotional little beats. The movie, for as like dark and kind of about these kind of sad people, is very alive in a way that feels constantly active throughout.
Yeah. And two things we have to say immediately. Number one, this actually is not Bogdanovich's first film. As soon as I said that, I was like, wait, that's not right. Of course, he did Targets before this. But people did say sort of the best young director since Orson Welles. I had to correct that because I knew I'd mess it up. The second thing, you want to talk about mean and cruel. Sybil Shepherd in this movie is like, it's, I actually watched this with my wife, and it was just so great to sit next to her and occasionally just have my wife just like out loud say, "Oh my God," when she would do certain things. And, you know, like, that's a tricky character, because that is very easy, you know, especially, you know, whether it's modernized looking at it or even at the time, to say, well, she's just kind of a bitch, right? And I actually think, like, the movie gives her more, because we talked about the fact that, you know, it's not entirely, like, sympathetic towards its characters. The movie actually, I think, has enough respect for that character to say, no, she's smart. She knows she has to find something to kind of, she has to kind of hitch her wagon to something. And so the movie actually, I think, kind of respects her in a way where it doesn't actually seem judgmental. And also, I think the movie's actually kind of impressed with how, you know, because a lot of the other characters are not necessarily super smart or don't come across as being the sharpest individuals. She's smart. She knows what's going on. And she knows exactly, the same to be said for somebody who knows who they are and how they can go about kind of getting what they want in the world. And she does. And
has learned a lesson from her mother in that regard too.
Yes, yes.
By the way.
Absolutely.
Ellen Burstyn. She's an attractive woman. I had not seen Ellen Burstyn since in that time. She's a hello.
Yes. Also Oscar nominated. There were four actors. And I actually want to talk about that in a second. But yeah, like she has learned that from her mother. And Burstyn's fantastic in this movie too. And you can kind of see like, oh, well, that's where it came from. That's you know, it was a passing thought. But while watching Sybil Shepherd in this movie, I thought a little bit about Tracy Flick in Election. Mm-hmm. Totally yeah. Different characters. But this idea of I'm too smart for this place. I got to get out of here. How am I going to do it? And in both cases, you do not look badly on that character, which I think is almost inherently a sexist thought, frankly, but that you think, no, they're smart and they're going to get out of here and they know how to do it. And there's an admiration, I think, that this movie has for her. Just to jump in and say this, you know, as I said, four performances got nominated. And I actually, all four of those performances are good, but I was actually kind of surprised which four was, because it's Jeff Bridges got nominated. He did not win. He was up against Ben Johnson, who did win. And then you have Ellen Burstyn, who was nominated, and Cloris Leachman, who did win. I like all four of them quite a lot, but Eileen Brennan, I also think, is fantastic as the waitress. And I was actually sort of surprised. I mean, in some ways, Burstyn isn't in the movie quite as much as even Brennan is, but you know, they're all kind of sort of fabulous. And it's, for me, like, you know, this movie was nominated for Best Picture and Best Director. It lost to The French Connection, I believe. And so for me, it kind of blows my mind that this movie came out the same year as Clockwork Orange, French Connection, because I think when we think about like the early 1970s, it's sort of like, oh, Hollywood's changing completely, and it's like rewriting the rules. This movie, in a lot of ways, feels like such a throwback. I mean, the John Ford comment is dead on. You're totally right. But even like those, like the way he sticks the camera in people's faces and it's so close up, it feels sort of, in certain ways, like more kind of modern in certain ways. And also makes you feel like, yeesh, like it creates a sense of feeling uncomfortable in certain situations. I remember really liking this movie, and so I was kind of curious if it would hold up. And, you know, not to just go on a rave rant here, but God, this movie is actually, I have to say, like, maybe, like, top 25, top 30 movies, you know, in terms of movies I really, really, really love.
Wow, yeah. And it is funny seeing, I'm surprised that Jeff Bridges, like, he's obviously very good in this, and man, like, impossibly young, younger than young Tron young. Like, very, like, you know, I remember we talked about Breaking Away and how incredibly young Dennis Quaid was. This is really young. Like, this is Jeff Bridges. Like, I can't believe how young he is in this movie. And I kind of like that he's, you know, I keep going back to their relationship, the relationship that he has with Sonny. Like, what's funny is, like, they're both, like, neither one of them is that smart. Neither one of them is that ambitious. And like, they're the reason the town it is. And I kind of love the idea that, you know, there's all of these old men that you like, you'll stop in a store, they'll be at the pool hall, and they'll just be these old men in those glasses, in those very specific glasses from like the early 1950s, all sitting around doing nothing. Sitting there commenting or vaguely commenting on the kids today or so on. And it is obvious to me that, and we'll talk about Texasville in a moment. It's obvious to me that like, this is where Sonny and, if he survives the war, Dwayne are going. They're just going to be them if the town survives enough to even let them be there.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought about the Dogville thing, going back to what you were saying earlier, which I think is really kind of interesting. Because in some ways I feel like this movie sort of says, you know, small towns are not actually fonts of, we joke about the real America a decent amount on this podcast. Without being snotty in the way that Dogville is, this movie sort of says, you know, some small towns, it's okay if they die off. It's there's almost like a Darwinian kind of, you know, and if you can't kind of hack it, then going to the war is the best of all of your options. And the movie's very, like, clear about that. I didn't research this. I also wonder if not just using the Hank Williams songs to kind of create a mood, but the fact that like this is right before Hank Williams died, like he died he dies in 1953. Like, I didn't know if like that was part of the theme of things going away, and all of that kind of like there's that sense to that too, that, you know, he's going to die pretty soon as well. Like, this whole world is going to be ending, pretty soon. And as somebody who, you know, people know, you and I grew up in a small town, that one of the things it does kind of like pierce in terms of being dead on correct is when Sonny comes back the next year, like after he's like graduated, and people kind of like, he goes to his back that high school football game, and maybe it's because the coach knows that he's sleeping with his wife, but he just sort of ignores him completely, and it's like, oh yeah, like you're just kind of nobody now. You're it's like, you know, it's like the Patton Oswalt thing about which birthdays you can celebrate. It's like right. It's like you're an adult. Shut up. Like, nobody, you're not special anymore. Nobody cares. That feeling of they just sort of cycle through and you better find something else. I think that's also really, really dead on. So
I'm curious, have you ever seen Texasville? I've not seen Texasville. It's a sequel that Peter Bogdanovich made with almost all of these same characters, at least all the ones that survived, the actors were still alive. All of the same characters in this made in, I think, the early 90s, late 80s. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never seen that or The Two Jakes, which came out the same year. Yeah, I heard they were both bad, so I thought, well, why would I want to like sully my memory of this? No, I never have. I have to admit, I was kind of curious again after seeing this new one or seeing the original. I thought, God, maybe I should just for curiosity's sake. But I have heard it's pretty awful.
Yeah, so it's just the poster is of Jeff Bridges and Cybill Shepherd, like, kissing each other like it's a romantic comedy or something. I'm like, well, okay, I don't want to see this movie. if that's what happens to these guys, I don't want to see this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'd be most interested about is kind of like T2 Trainspotting. Like, is that movie actually about the toxicity of nostalgia or one's own nostalgia? Or is it just going to be, hey, the gang's back together. Remember those crazy times we once had? If it's the latter, I'm definitely not interested.
All right. Well, so that is The Last Picture Show. Very, very happy to have gotten to watch that. It kind of knocked us both on our arse. So let's go now, Grierson, from one of your 25 favorite movies of all time to a movie that I'm wondering makes the cut. It's time to discuss The Room.
Hi.
Can I help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?
Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so The Room.
But just to jump in, we love and we take seriously our introductions for the movies. That sounded like resignation.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I'm again, I'm describing what happens in the room is not really worth doing. It's more just talking about the phenomenon of the room. The Room came out in 2003, was written, directed, starring, financed in somewhat shady ways, apparently, by this very strange man of indeterminate origin and age named Tommy Wiseau. It's funny because it's known generally as one of the worst movies of all time. Grace and I had never seen it. As we discussed on last podcast, we generally are of the rule, we both agree with this, that there are so many great movies in the world. Occasionally you get to go watch The Last Picture Show again and have this like wonderful experience of movies that either a great movie you haven't seen or a wonderful movie that you get to relive the idea of why you would sit down and watch a bad movie. And spend 2 hours you could spend watching. It's hard enough to fit in all the movies you want to see. So why would you want to spend that time? So The Room, I think for that, I think you, Garcia, you could agree that's the main reason neither one of us have ever seen it before now, correct?
Yeah. If I'm debating whether or not I have time for Texasville, the Room is not something I'm not going to prioritize it. Yeah.
Yes. And of course, we talked about this a little bit when we did Gymkhana. And the idea of these famously bad movies. I think Best Worst Movie came out recently, which is about Troll 2. But I will say, The Room, you look at a movie like Troll 2, or you look at like clips of the movie like Troll 2, and it's just like, I know that there is this sort of collection. I understand the midnight movie phenomenon and the idea that people love to come and have these shared experience with them. It's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine recently who's a big Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan. And I kind of said my theory about like why I don't like to watch bad movies. And he's like, Bubby, you love Mystery Science Theater 3000, which I do. But the reason I love that is not because, oh, it's fun making fun of bad movies. The reason I like it is because those guys are really funny. And they're creating something funny, and therefore I get to watch them do something funny. I don't really care about the bad thing that they're making fun of. What's funny is what they have to say about it. So the idea of I don't necessarily want to be those people myself, if that makes sense. So watching The Room, though, I will say The Room, like I watch a movie like Gymkhana and I'm like, all right, this is terrible. But I know why it's terrible. Like some rich guy said, hey, I think I'll make a new sort of American martial arts movie. And you see the mindset of the human beings who came together. They thought they could make a quick buck this way, or they thought they could do this. They just don't really know how to make movies, or they did it really cheap, or in reality, a man like Tor would be running into this problem all the time. Famous quote from Ed Wood. Like, you understand it, and that's funny in like a passing way, but not something that I find myself compelled or particularly entertained by in a lasting way. The Room, to me, I have to say, is a lot more fascinating. I'm not gonna lie. This movie obviously is terrible, but it is terrible in a... It feels like a found object. Remember Found? You know, the old publication where they would find these strange random things in the world. You just look, they'd find a letter. They'd find this odd thing that you can't believe that reality exists in a way that allows something like this to exist. And that is what The Room is for me. I don't understand how this is an object that exists in the physical universe that we all inhabit. and in a way, like, again, I get Troll 2. I get Gymkhana. I know why these things exist. I don't know what this is. It is a movie that you watch and you're like, okay, this is so bad that it feels like it's a prank, but it's not, because if it were a prank, there'd be a moment that it winked. There'd be a moment of self-awareness. For all the bad stuff in this movie, the bad dialogue, the bad acting, to me, the truly fascinating thing about this, and I know I'm not saying anything new here, it's him. It's the guy that created this movie. The most amazing thing about it is not that, like, oh, this is really incompetently directed. I think you could do a whole film class essay on the flower shop scene itself. Just this scene where just, like, everything is wrong. Just, like, in an amazing way that I found myself... I don't watch a lot of scenes in movies like 5 or 10 times. And I went after I watched that scene and rewound it and watched it again and rewound it and watched it again, which to me is something that for the first time gave me a window into why people would want to do that. But for me, so much of this is about him. The idea that the worldview of a person that makes this movie, which is basically just about my girlfriend cheated on me and she's a bitch and I'm angry and I'm going to get back at her. that seems to be the driving influence of this movie. The amount of will and focus and anger and the number of things that had to come together to make this document, I will say it was obviously terrible, but it was a fascinating terrible.
Yeah, I definitely see that. I mean, I think whether it's like Plan 9 from outer space or something like this, I think what the allure is two things. The singular vision and the sincerity of executing and believing in that singular vision. Because, you know, the whole like auteur theory of movies and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's sort of like almost like this is like the argument for the anti-auteur theory. Like, if you're just a horrible auteur, that still shapes a movie in kind of a fascinating way. There is a lot of stuff that is just so terrible. You know, we talked about nostalgia in terms of Last Picture Show. When I was starting, when I first started writing film reviews professionally, you know, living in Los Angeles, I would, you know, because I was like the new guy, I was like the low man on the totem pole, right? And so I would do what, you know, is known as the four-walled films, where a producer or a director just pays a theater to play their movie for a week. And so we would review these for like LA Weekly. And so I saw some pretty terrible movies, which were complete vanity projects and stuff like that. Watching The Room, I was sort of reminded of that time in Los Angeles when those types of movies sort of existed and you would go see them and you just sort of knew that they were awful. This is easily the worst, though I will say for the two people who might be listening to this podcast and remember Dog Lover's Symphony, which is my version of The Room, where I'm always like quoting it to the two other people who have watched it with me, that's the one I feel kind of that I think that kind of fascination I think that you have, Will, for The Room, where it's like, how does this exist? What were they thinking? The one thing I have to say is that what makes my even say fascination with this movie uncomfortable and what connects it with other movies like the one I just mentioned is that there is something I always feel a little kind of queasy about in terms of somebody who is, since his origins are sort of unknown, probably born in a foreign country. There is something that's a little...
I get it.
There's something a little, ha-ha, he doesn't talk like us, that does... And I'm not saying you're saying this, but I think that that is part of the general fascination with this movie, and that doesn't entirely sit well with me because there is a certain amount of... I will just sort of speculate of... his English is terrible and he doesn't understand like how words work the way we do. That informs what makes this movie funny. And it's clear that the other actors are perhaps not being directed so well, or, you know, the dialogue is not so great because it's somebody whose English is not so great. I don't know. That's an assumption I am making, but it does make it a little hard to entirely, be okay with enjoying the awfulness, because there is something that feels kind of xenophobic or kind of dickish about that. That being said, the thing that I actually kind of found fascinating is that the idea of calling this movie The Room, and, you know, I almost joked on Twitter that this is the tragic story of a woman who cannot leave her house because she's just like she's trapped in her house the entire time. There is something that's like, psychological thriller fascinating about this idea of characters who are stuck in the same room having the same kind of like arguments over and over again. You know, it's not to this level, obviously, but there's almost something kind of like Bergman-esque about that type of thing that is kind of fascinating, where it's like, yeah, because there were a couple, because the walls are red, I actually thought, wow, this is like Autumn Sonata and Cries and Whispers. And so if I know that Mr. Wiseau is always looking for quotes that are positive, feel free to use that one. There is something that's kind of fascinating with this idea of like, and I think that he said this in like interviews, like that was actually something that he wanted to do, this idea of like, these people are trapped. So I actually think like as a technique in cinematic history, that can be effective. But we talked about this with Last Picture Show, like, oh, you know, the Sybil Shepherd character is so fascinating and she's nuanced in terms of, like, nobody's fascinating and no one's nuanced. And the characters who are bitches, they're bitches. And that's just the way it's supposed to be. That woman is terrible. You're supposed to hate her. I guess mission accomplished, because I kind of hated that character. I kind of hate all the characters. If a movie with the worst scenes, the most unbelievable scenes of people throwing a football around. That,
yes, in tuxedos. Don't forget, they do it in tuxedos for no reason. Tuxedos. And then he falls and gets hurt, and I didn't know why.
Yeah, because he said he didn't want to, Will. He said he didn't want, yes.
I hope her breast cancer turned out okay.
Wait, was that a thing?
The mom, when she's like, I got the test back. It's definitely breast cancer. Like, oh, that's okay. They take care of it. That happens to people all the time. Don't worry about it. Okay. And then it's never referred to again. And they just kind of move on.
Okay. I see this movie has layers. I had forgotten that. I just have to go back and watch it.
Forgot the scene where the mom was like, I got the test back. I definitely have breast cancer. Did you black out?
I think I am now remembering that scene. This movie is sort of like, wait, I didn't rewind any scene. I didn't do this Ebert style where I analyze each scene at the University of Colorado like you did, apparently. I had forgotten that scene. It's now coming back to me. This movie is not unlike, the two martini lunch of the things you said that you forgot at the two martini.
two martini lunch, I'll say anything. We got a husbands and wives quote, by the way, in our review of The Room. I'm very proud to say that.
Bergman and Woody Allen, you're welcome, America.
Yeah. Also, just for what it's worth, there's just other like random like little moments where like I had to check and see if did this come out before they did the chicken dance on Arrested Development, because every single time that they know, like there's a moment where one of the worst things you can do is to call someone a chicken, which I think speaks to, again, Wiseau's kind of weird notion of masculinity and what these things are. And just to get someone to do it, you call them a chicken. But again, I had the Jason Bateman. Does anyone in this family know what a chicken looks like?
maybe he's just a big fan of Back to the Future is part 2 and 3. Where that, yes, that, again, that major but, plot point in those. In those
but does films. Anyone this movie with a chicken? A chicken sounds like. The reason that I feel more, I get what you're saying about how like this whole movie seems like it's been through Google Translate a couple of times, and even conceptually it's been through that. So I see what you're saying on that. That said, there is something kind of poisonous about the way that he sees like women, frankly, that I find makes me forgive myself a little bit when I deal. Like it is to me, I just go back and maybe we could go on for too much on this. I go back to that flower shop sequence. That to me is like, it's hypnotic. Like you could not do a scene that wrong if you were trying to. And it's just a short scene. It's like 10 seconds. And it's just, it gets like five things wrong. It just encapsulates. I will say, like, I watched Gymkhana and I was like, I don't, like, yeah, it's bad. Whatever. Like, I get it. But I will say, watching The Room, I'm not going to join the cult or anything. I think I can comfortably wash my hands of this movie now that it is over. However, I did find myself understanding why people would not in general want to watch bad movies or get fascinated with bad movies, but why they might get fascinated by this one.
Well, I think what's interesting is that I am having a much better time talking with you about this movie than I did watching it, which I saw it by myself. And I think that, you know, in terms of collective experiences, that is actually something that's kind of great about bad movies, is the back and forth of, oh my God, what about that? Oh my God, wasn't that terrible? That the shared experience makes it more pleasurable. And I think also is what the appeal of that cult in general for bad movies is that you get to share that with people. And, you know, nowadays when we're talking about like, how do we make films more of a collective experience? You know, and people are watching stuff at home, it's not the same thing as going to a theater. There is something to be said for a bunch of people sharing the fact that they, you know, enjoy the hell out of watching something like The Room. The other thing I have to say about the flower shop scene, I don't think he's legally parked up front.
No, I don't think he is. He is not.
That was my big takeaway. Like, I'm pretty sure you're going to get a ticket.
Yeah. Also, apparently, if this movie is to be taken as a documentary, I have been having sex very wrong.
My entire life. Yeah. Not to delve into this too much, but I did kind of think, that's how I should be. Just in general, I'm not a stairwell guy, but apparently there's much to be learned from steps and things like that. I did almost start timing the first half an hour of how many sex scenes there were per, like, try to figure out how many there were per minute, because the first half an hour is pretty much dominated by
the sex scenes. Yes,
by sex scenes. I would not recommend any of the pickup moves in this movie to impressionable youths who might be listening. I don't think any of them are actually going to. But to be fair, I've been married for a while, so maybe they are effective. I wouldn't recommend them to anybody.
This brings up the notion, by the way, that there is, of course, a movie coming out called The Disaster Artist about the making of this film. It is directed by James Franco. He plays Tommy Wiseau. Dave Franco, his brother, plays Greg Sestero, which I feel like will be an interesting dynamic, because I also think part of the weirdness of this movie is that Tommy Wiseau seems to maybe be in love with, seems to like certainly have some envy of the attractiveness of Greg Sestero. So the fact that his brother's playing that, and it got very good reviews at South by Southwest this year. So I'm definitely curious. I'm glad we've at least seen that before we actually see that movie. Otherwise, we might be a little baffled.
I will say that, you know, we occasionally on the Twitter feed will mention what reboot movie we're getting ready to watch. By far, the most euphoric reactions of any of those that we put on Twitter was for The Room. People were excited. People were volunteering their services to be on the podcast with us because they were so excited to talk about. The one thing I have to say is that because I live in Los Angeles, I was here when this movie came out. It played at the Sunset Five back when it was known as the Sunset Five. And my now wife and I would go to movies together. And we would see, we'd see trailers for upcoming films at the Sunset Five, and they would tend to be art house and foreign language films and stuff like that. Then this trailer for The Room would come on, and it would be incredibly sincere, melodramatic. You know, this idea, this intense love story and this romantic triangle. The people who haven't even seen The Room, who live in Los Angeles, know the line, "You're tearing me apart," because it was used in the trailer, and people would be primed to laugh at it when it came on because they knew, oh, it's this shitty looking movie called The Room. And I say that only to say that at the time it came out, he thought this was a serious thing. I actually watched this on DVD through Netflix, and I watched the trailers with interest. They don't make it seem like that now. He really kind of repositioned this movie to be like, it's a dark comedy. He did not think it was a dark comedy at the time. He thought this was a serious, searing, romantic drama that he was creating. And so it's funny to have lived long enough to watch that movie change and him kind of lean into the idea that, oh yeah, it's a comedy. So thank you for the very nice review. And I guess thanks. This is as dumb as it is to say, this is a movie that is culturally significant. And so I guess I'm glad I saw it.
I will say, like, I did not feel, after we saw Gymkhana, go back to Gymkhana, the other bad movie, the other, we'll dare you to watch this movie that we've done in this podcast. Gymkhana, I found a lot, like, it was over. It's like, yep, that was terrible. And this, I'm not gonna lie to you, I've thought about this movie quite a bit since I saw it. I really have. As just a cultural object, I understand the fascination. So not only am I glad I saw it, I'm probably going to read up on this movie a little bit more. It entranced me a little bit more than it entranced you. I'm not going to start watching really terrible movies. I'm not going to change my theory, my mindset on that. Because again, otherwise I'll go watch Last Picture Show again. That was so much more fun. However, I understand why people are fascinated by The Room, and I'm quietly a little fascinated by it myself.
This is like a weird crush you have on this movie, where you're like,
I do.
And no, this is like the, no, shut up, I don't like her. I'm like, dude, you totally love her. And you're like, no.
I do.
And
you do. I kind of do.
Well, I wish you both the best.
Yeah, it's going to work out great for us, I'm sure. you're tearing me apart, The Room. Okay, that was bad. I'll probably cut that out because that was a horrible thing that I just did. Okay, so that is our show this week. If you want us to switch this podcast to an All The Room podcast, one of those podcasts that are a big thing now where you discuss 1 minute of a movie in every podcast. Do you want to do that with me, Grierson, about The Room?
No. I don't want to do that. Listen, I think we should continue doing this podcast, which the people seem to like.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they prefer The Room win. I'm in love with The Room. I apologize for nothing. I regret nothing. Okay, so
he then jumped out the window.
Yes, exactly. Or I mean, we've talked about the ending. Let's just move on. Okay,
no, the ending is. This I have to say about the ending. I give the movie credit for going all the way. The movie's ending is, you see what you did. I hope you're happy. Like that. Yes. It has a commitment which I respect. Sure.
Yes, let's go with that. Okay, so that is our show for this week. We'll be back to discuss The Room for an hour next week. Or, I was going to say, you can vote. Grierson Leach, go to Twitter, Grierson Leach, and you can vote, which whether you want us to do another full hour show on The Room or discuss the new releases. But I'm a little afraid with what the results
will
be.
Yeah, we're not. So we can't. We can't
get that idea.
We can't.
Okay, well, we have two new movies to discuss. The first movie that we will be discussing is Graduation, which is a Romanian movie written and directed by Christian Mungiu. Is that right, Grierson?
Maybe not so French with the pronunciation, but you got it.
Mungiu.
I said less French, not more.
I'm sorry. Everything I do is French. This was won the Best Director Award at Cannes, actually tied with Olivia Sayas for Personal Shopper, a movie that Mark Lasanti and I discussed a couple weeks ago. It was one of the big hits from Cannes. It is out next week, so we'll be discussing that next week. We'll also be discussing Colossal. Colossal is a movie starring Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis, directed by Nacho Vigalondo, which is also French, right?
with zest. I like a zestful pronunciation. That's
Nacho Vigalondo.
I know at least one person is thinking, hey, I sent Time Crimes to those guys for a reboot. At some point, we should also do Time Crimes as a
reboot. We will. But right now, we are going to discuss the new release of the movie, which is Colossal. So next week, we have two new movies to discuss. Nacho Vigalondo's Colossal and Graduation. We also have one reboot movie. The reboot movie this week is The Last of the Mohicans, written and directed by Michael Mann. Came out in 1992, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, Madeline Stowe, Russell Means. No matter how far it takes, no matter how far, no matter how long it takes, no matter how far, I will find you. Stay alive, no matter what occurs.
The amount of impressions, this is amazing. I think it's important, by the way, we should tell our listeners that the only version of The Last of the Mohicans that exists now is the definitive director's cut, or whatever that new version that Michael Mann did a couple years ago. So it will actually be a new movie for us, Will.
No matter how long it takes, no matter how far, I will find you.
He was just waiting for me to stop talking. That's what just happened.
The next podcast is going to be nothing but us discussing The Room and me quoting lines from The Last of the Mohicans.
which was on Will's top 10 that year that it came out.
I love that movie. I'm happy to discuss it again. Stay alive! Okay.
There are also other lines of dialogue which we will be reacquainting ourselves with when we watch. Wouldn't it be great if the director's cut, that line is not in there?
Oh my God, I shut it off. This movie sucks.
where's The Room? I need to watch it again.
I'll put up the poll. I might put up the poll, Grierson, just to upset you.
I think we should solve this by having a race in the woods together. You and me, whoever wins. by the way, you also shouldn't run that way. Just the running technique is terrible.
There's all sorts of. I liked your joke on Twitter. Jesus Christ, they can't even sing "Happy Birthday" right.
That was my tweet. That was my thing where I'm like, I don't think anybody here has heard "Happy Birthday" to you. They've never been to a birthday party. All right.
Listen, you may have had a miserable experience. I had a blast. All right, Kirsten, have a great week. We'll be back next week to discuss The Room, The Room, The Room, and The Room. Have a great week, Kirsten.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Johnny and I loved my life with my best friend Mark and my future wife. I bought her flowers from the flower store. They said I'm their favorite customer. We got wasted on vodka and scotch and made love while the neighbor Denny watched. I gave her a red dress, I gave her my heart. What did she do but tear me apart? You're tearing me